and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and I'm here with you every Tuesday at noon. Real Talk is the show that seeks to answer questions, large and small. If you've got a question you'd like us to answer, send it to me at realtalk@voiceofvashon.org, and I will find an expert to answer that question. Today's question is a big one, and it's mostly for white people. It is, how do I participate in racism? And my guest today to help us research that question, I'm not sure there are final answers, is Debbie Irving. She is author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. She's not only an author, she's a racial justice educator and public speaker, a community organizer, and she's been a classroom teacher who's grappled with and worked toward an understanding of racial injustice for years. She's going to be here on Vashon Saturday, February 10th, from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Methodist Church. Debbie, welcome, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure, and this is a gigantic topic, one that sort of slept in your awareness for many years. Your book is a soul-searching account of growing up asleep in white Massachusetts until you became a school teacher. You said you could feel racial tensions but didn't understand them. What were your first inklings?
Well, so I had two work chapters. One was as a nonprofit manager of arts organizations, and that happened before I became a school teacher. Ah. And so it was in those years, so I was age, 23 to 33 or so in that chapter, and it was in those years that I first started to encounter something that felt really wrong. And the easiest way to describe that is I had grown up in a white suburb north of Boston, Winchester, Massachusetts, and this work, this nonprofit management work, brought me into downtown, into neighborhoods in and around Boston. And it was so clear to me that I could walk across the street and walk out of a neighborhood where buildings were intact and shiny and everybody was white, and into a neighborhood that was dilapidated buildings, falling apart schools, and the people were invariably black and brown. Hmm. And so I could observe something, but I had no language for it, I had no understanding for it, and it caused just this huge dissonance in me.
Were you scared?
I think we're all in the United States of America exposed to really scary stereotypes about black and brown people, be it like the black male thug or mm-hmm. the drug-selling, raping Mexican, fill in the blank of the negative stereotypes that get wrongly perpetuated. So I definitely had that in me, but oddly, I never felt afraid. I felt sad and sorry. I wanted to help people who I assumed somehow couldn't help themselves. And that's tied into that old American narrative that the playing field is level and anyone can make it as long as you work hard enough.
Yeah. The American dream, right?
Yeah. Mm. Mm-hmm. A hot word right now. Term right now.
Isn't it?
And so I drew the conclusion, without even really having a conscious understanding that I was drawing it, but the connection I made was, wow, like these people must not be able to work hard enough or know how to work hard enough or, something's wrong here, and they need my help, said 23-year-old Debbie Irving. So that was kind of the beginning of my journey, and it's also crucial to know that I spent 25 years in that trying to help and fix headspace.
Yes.
Before I actually understood what was going on. I was on diversity committees. I was raising money to help people in those neighborhoods, and I had no idea what I was actually dealing with.
So what were you actually dealing with? What did you discover, and how?
I think what scares me, and the reason I wrote the book, is that I would never have discovered it, I don't think, if I hadn't signed up to go to graduate school at the age of 48. At this time, I was also a classroom teacher. I go to graduate school. There is a mandatory first course called Racial and Cultural Identities. And it was in that course, that half a year long course, that I was finally exposed to history, a different version of history about the United States that I had never learned, not even as a history major at Kenyon College. And I'm not pointing fingers at Kenyon in any way that I wouldn't point fingers at any American right. institution of higher ed, because especially back then it wasn't taught. So there's this whole history that that most white people don't know about what is race. I thought it was biological. It turns out it's a legal term, you know, social and economic political construct. I thought the playing field was level. It turns out that there have been, using the invention of a white race and then making that race, the group in charge, there's been policy after policy. And through the years, it has diverted resources disproportionately to that group at the expense of everybody else.
Give us some examples of some of those policies, because particularly you talk about cringeworthy discoveries in your book, and I think some of those policies might be among those cringeworthy discoveries. So can you give us an idea of some of those policies that have perpetuated racism institutionally?
Yeah, there's so many. I talk a lot about the GI Bill in my book, and I still think it's one of the greatest points of entry. And that, so my father was in World War II. He received the GI Bill, which meant, and there were four components of it. He used two. He went to Harvard Law School for free on that GI Bill, and he and my mom bought their first home in Winchester, Massachusetts for $17,000 on that bill. I knew about the GI Bill my whole life. It had been held up for me by my parents and other GI Bill friends and family, that it was a way that America took care of its own. That's what America did, took care of its own.
Mm-hmm.
And welcoming back all these young men from World War II and saying, hey, you know, thanks, guys. We want you to get started on your new life. Here's your big reward, GI Bill. And what I never understood until I was in that course was that there were GIs who were not white. There were 1.2 million black GIs. I didn't even know that. And if I didn't know that, I couldn't know that the GI Bill was not available, not accessible, I should say, to most of those 1.2 black GIs or indigenous or Latino or Asian American GIs who were also over there.
And that was no accident.
It was no accident. Although it said nowhere in the GI Bill that it was a white-only bill, the way it played out was that there were pre-existing barriers all around U.S. society, and there still are, by the way. But the way it intersected with the GI Bill was, so the education, that's a huge benefit. So why couldn't black and brown GIs use that? Well, at the time, this is the 1940s, there was a quota system in higher ed, two black spots, two Jewish spots, two fill-in-the-blank spots, and those filled right up. It is true that historically black colleges and universities were able to absorb some of the black GIs, but there was another, this is going to give you a sense of just the layers of this, there was another complicating factor, which is that you need time to go to higher ed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Black and brown GIs often had to come rushing home from the war and get back into the workforce in order to provide for parents, extended family, where because of the diversion of resources through U.S. history towards white people, black and brown communities are in many cases impoverished or barely getting by, much less wealth there. And so when a black or brown person receives a salary or makes money, it's a cultural norm in those groups to distribute it around the family. So a lot of these men, black and brown returning GIs, had to get right in the workforce. They couldn't take time off to go to school. And the reason white families, for example, like my grandparents on both sides, they were doing just fine. They didn't need my father's support, in part because of Social Security, which was a prior racialized program. That was originally mainly a white-only program because it excluded domestic and agricultural workers who were disproportionately black and brown.
That's another surprise.
Yeah, and we haven't even talked about housing yet, which is the big one that just knocked my socks off. So When GIs are returning, from World War II, it's the 1940s, this great bill is available, and yet, on the ground, the housing and lending market has colluded to create racialized maps all over the country, designating certain neighborhoods as white-only, and that is where the GI Bill was good. And so a black or brown GI couldn't take the housing portion and of the bill and use it because he couldn't get into a neighborhood that would have him. And for listeners saying, what? This can't be true. What you're looking for is it was the Federal Housing Authority, the FHA, that had invented the mortgage in the 1930s and set out with another couple agencies and as well as private banks to do this whole mapping system called redlining.
Yes.
Redlining is because black and brown neighborhoods were outlined in red. That's what you're looking for. And in the FHA guidelines, it said, you know, hey, banks, you're going to be making loans to regular people to go buy everyday homes. This is new for you. We want to help you manage your risk. We want you to think about two things with regard to risk. One, the condition of the building, which makes sense to me because that's, you know, who wants to invest in a falling apart building. And two, the skin color of the residents. So written into FHA guidelines in the 1940s and prior to that and a little bit after that was the skin color, these words, the skin color of residents. No, the presence of even one or two non-white families can undermine real estate values.
At that time, is that still true?
It's not true. Unfortunately, that scheme, that plan, was so vast and so deep-rooted that a lot of the housing deeds that got written then had restrictive covenants about future sales only going to white people.
Huh.
And the footprint that it laid down, and you can still look at any one of the cities or towns all over the country, and you can still walk around the city, and you can guess where you are and look at a red line map, and you're right. Because the U.S. government pumped $120 billion from its coffers into the hands of private, everyday GI citizens, American citizens, through the GI Bill housing portion, $120 billion. And 98% of it went to white families like mine.
That is shocking. Are those redlining maps or redlined maps used now in some of the gerrymandering and voting areas that are being remapped?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I would have to guess that if they're not used, an iteration that grew out of them is used.
So that restriction on voting is another of the institutional perpetuations of racism that continues today, are they not?
Right. And you can take anything in United States society, you can just take voting, and you can do a deep dive into it, and you can see that there's not one barrier, but that there are multiple barriers. So gerrymandering is one way to change up who's voting where, and then there's all the barriers once one gets to the voting space. You know, what kind of ID is involved, who's running the outfit, and what kind of feeling of safety or threat are they posturing with? And the other thing is, you know, there are countries where they take the day off of work in order to vote.
What a concept! Yeah.
What a concept! Yeah. So having it during work hours for guess who in this country is more likely to have to work two or three jobs and not be able to get to the voting polls, and to be suspicious that their vote is even going to be counted, or if they'll be safe going in and out of a space that they're not used to going into. So all of these many, many factors, they weave in and they wrap around and they just hold this whole thing in place in ways that a white person like me never even had to know that it existed, because the world did feel totally fair to me.
Of course. You're listening to Real Talk on Voice of Vashon. We are talking with Debbie Irving, author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. And we can do this thanks to Windermere Vashon Real Estate, who makes all our community information, programming, and our emergency alert service possible. Debbie, you have taken a deep personal plunge into white privilege and how your life was improved or has been improved and supported by it, and how it may have been at the expense or probably is at the expense of people of color. Your book is fascinating and very telling for all of us white people. I'm wondering two things. What kind of reactions have you gotten from white people and from people of color to your book?
Well, you know, there's always a wide range, so I'm always looking for patterns. The predominant pattern is what I would have expected and what I hoped for, and that is white people saying, oh, my God, I had no idea. How could this be? Why wasn't I taught this in school? What do I do? There's a sense of alarm. And also there's often that comes with that is something else, which I didn't expect so much, but it's a real, often it's tears. It's not outright tears, but there's a welling up. People want, when they come to talk to me, they often get very choked up and say, you know, talk about the spiritual aspects of it. Because I think one of the many things that white people don't know, and I didn't know, is the way that the culture of whiteness not only holds in place our racial caste system in the United States, but it asks us to really deny our own humanity in ways that are crippling to us. And I think there's a people simultaneously feel a sense of horror at what they didn't know and a sense of possible freedom and liberation and hope for this sense of, I knew something wasn't right. It didn't feel right when I was a child being taught, you know, not to bring up this or not to bring up that or not to be curious. And so even within that one group I'm discussing, there's a wide range. And then I would say the predominant response from people of color is, I knew it. I knew that I knew that you all harbored all of this these thoughts, but weren't willing to admit it. And when I say these thoughts, I mean I really was exposed to stereotypes, and I would have denied it for a long time because I thought it would be cruel to speak it. But in fact, it's a huge relief to say, all right, now we can do something. Now you're admitting it. Now you're admitting you bought into white superiority, Debbie. Thank you. Thank you for admitting it. Now we can start a relationship.
Boy, and that, I think, is something that holds a lot of folks back from taking action, or yes, even from admitting the truth. Partially, and I think you write about this in your book as well, the fear of saying something wrong, of saying something that might be offensive. And in your book, you tell stories about times that you were called out by women of color, particularly, for things that you said. Can you relate some of those stories to us?
Yeah. I mean, it really is a fear that, oh, my God, I'm going to say something stupid or I used to say I was worried I would hurt someone's feelings, but you know what was really underneath that was a fear of me creating a mess that I didn't have any of the tools to clean up because I didn't have conflict resolution skills. We were just taught in my household to basically sweep it under the rug, buck up, ignore it, don't rock the boat.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you know, one example, a big example, a major learning for me was I ended up at a conference that was designed for employees of color in schools in the education system. And it was really meant to be a chance for people of color, employees of color, to come together and say, what are we experiencing? Like, how much are we hurting? What do we have to do for our own self-care? And, you know, what can we bring back to our white institutions to help them understand what they can do better on the diversity and inclusion front? And I inserted myself into that conference because I had been told it would be a really great idea to feel what it was like to be in the minority, the racial minority. That's a different story. But what I did do was I just assumed, like, it didn't occur to me what the impact would be to be a white person in a room that wasn't really meant for white people. So yeah, of course I'm standing out like a sore thumb. And in this particular workshop I attended, they showed a movie, a rough cut of a film that they were putting together for schools to take a look at so schools could better understand what the issues are for people of color in predominantly white institutions. And as soon as it was done, I raised my hand and stood up to offer feedback, which, A, I really shouldn't have even been there, and B, to be the first person to speak up. And 1, 2, 3 black women in that room let me know really quickly, like, this isn't your space. Like, what are you doing? And my first response was not, and it was all happening in my head. I knew enough to keep quiet, in part because there was a woman beside me who said, don't say anything, don't say anything. thankfully. But my first thought was not, oh, my God, how arrogant of me. What was I thinking? Wow, look how entitled I feel, even when I'm not in a white space. Holy cow, look how conditioned I am to step into a space and feel like I can just offer up my opinion. That is not what I thought. That's what I would think now if it happened, even though I don't think I would create that situation again. But what I thought was, oh, they don't understand me. They're so unappreciative. Like, I don't have to be here. So you can hear the difference in my before and after.
That was an educational experience.
It was an educational experience, and it would have not gone as deep as it did if not for 5 people in that room who missed their next session and instead stayed with me to help me understand in a really kind and generous way what had just happened. That blew my mind.
What exactly did they say to you?
They tried to point out there's so much history, and we are all so bottled up. We have to show up with such strict parameters on who we can be in these white institutions, and this is our one chance to just kind of come and let loose. And they weren't just saying what they said to you. You were a stand-in in that moment for every white woman who's ever pissed them off or, you know, stepped on their toes or taken a job that really should have gone to them or treated their mother wrong. There's just so much history in the room. And they also were incredibly generous with just kind of letting me talk and sob, which I was crying at that point, about like, I don't understand. Maybe I'm in over my head. What did just happen? And so it was a really intense exchange, and I knew enough, at least, to be so grateful that these people were taking time for me. And I've actually stayed in touch with one of those people, and she's become a really dear friend.
You know, that speaks to so much, including the generosity of the oppressed. And that story you tell reminds me of the folks in Charleston, South Carolina, who forgave the shooter who killed 9 of their mm-hmm. parishioners, mm-hmm. With such incredible grace. I look at those people and I think, there's no way I can measure up to that, that kind of kindness and grace. I don't know where you put that into your book, if indeed you did. It's just a concept that struck me as I was listening to you tell that story. I did find a quote in your book that somewhat relates to this. Colorblindness, a philosophy that denies the way lives play out differently along racial lines, actually maintains the very cycle of silence, ignorance, and denial that needs to be broken for racism to be dismantled. And I think a lot of us who are progressives or liberals live in color blindness and think that we've got this whole thing licked. What would you say to us?
Well, I would say, do you really? First of all, color blindness was promoted to you as a strategy. So you're not crazy for having that language and thinking that you have that mindset. So the question would be, do you really have that mindset? Do you really not notice color? You know, of course you notice it. I would say to men, do you notice when you meet a person if it's a male or female? And women, do you notice if it's mm-hmm. a male or female? Of course we notice gender, we notice age, we notice all kinds of things about one another. And it's that noticing that allows us to relate in ways that are appropriate for whoever we're engaging with, particularly before we know them as, you know, once we get the dimensions of a person's history and experiences and personality and we're developing a relationship, of course, you know, we get much more nuance in our exchanges. But those initial exchanges were always modulating based on someone's identities. And so to pretend we don't see race is just not real. And people of color would like to have their race noticed and recognized and have white people understand what that means.
Yeah, it seems to me the idea of colorblindness and not recognizing that a person is black or brown sort of minimizes that person, as if to say, well, I'm going to pretend you're white.
Right, and I don't know any person of color in the world who would like to be white. It's not a positive thing in many people of color's minds, even though they're forced to perform it every day. Many of them, they want access to resources, if they want jobs, if they want, you know, higher education, if they want education outside of, if they want education, period, they have to perform whiteness.
That's horrifying in and of itself. In fact, I was speaking with a young black mother today who lives in Tacoma and is very well educated and well spoken. And one of the things she said, the basics of life for a black mother is that she has to worry about whether her son is going to come home every night.
Yeah.
Because he steps out on the street and someone might decide to shoot him for no reason. That just blows me away right there.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Debbie Irving, author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. And the Portland Herald called your book a brave and important cultural memoir, a deep and personal exploration of your own role in the dominant white culture's perpetuation of systemic racism. I want to ask you, what, if any, progress do you see in the culture's breaking of systemic racism? Where's it going?
Well, you know, from many angles, I see progress. The younger generation that's coming up is really different. They are not as invested in the don't rock the boat, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all culture that people in my generation, so I'm born in 1960, grew up with. And they're also likely to be in institutions that are more racially integrated. And so a lot of what I'm talking about is happening at the educational arena. Higher ed is offering so many more courses. The history is changing a little bit in some institutions in terms of what gets taught. And, you know, I think that there are people who are, I don't want to sound like a this is a conspiracy, but people are embedded. There are people now working in virtually every sector of society who understand how all of this operates and are getting increasingly skilled at interrupting it. So I'm talking about the healthcare industry, the transportation industry, the food supply, financial lending, housing. And so I do think that there's sort of a front of people who are moving and who are understanding change. One of the major differences is, especially for people who were active around the civil rights, I mean, the civil rights era was really about making change on paper. It was about laws.
Yes, and that doesn't change human behavior.
And that doesn't change belief systems or the human behavior that comes out of it. And so what I feel we are in right now is I feel like we had civil rights laws and now we're in civil rights lies. And a lot of the myths are getting exposed. And the other thing that's happening, and I think this is what my work specifically revolves a lot around, what are the everyday behaviors that white people, what is whiteness? What does it look like from a behavioral standpoint? And how might I be showing up in ways that hold oppression, that are oppressive and contribute to a larger system of oppression just because I don't know the way I embody whiteness or the lies that keep me ignorant and allow me to keep, you know, behaving in ways I do. The biggest example I have is the white savior syndrome, which is what I started out the show talking about, which is
That's
wanting
right.
to, quote-unquote, help and fix.
Debbie Irving, I can't thank you enough. We are unfortunately out of time. If you folks go to the Methodist Church on February 10th at 3 o'clock, you're going to find out more about how you might be able to get around those lies that we've all been living with and do something better in the area of racism. This has been Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and I'm here every Tuesday at noon. Please join me for lunch for the show that seeks to answer questions large and small. Send your ideas to realtalk@voiceofvashon.org. I want to thank producers Kaya Boding, Gail Kellner, Bill West, and the composer of our theme music, Luke McQuillan. And thank you for listening.